Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on personal identification. All right, if you remember last time, we talked about this thing of personal identification in the context of Heibel versus 6th Judicial District Court of Nevada, Humboldt County. The Nevada Supreme Court ruled against Heibel. He took the case on over to the United States Supreme Court. They ruled against him also. We discussed why it was that such a ruling existed. Heibel did not successfully put forth the logic, reason, and common sense behind his Fourth and Fifth Amendment claims that he had a right to remain silent. The courts now come up with a distinguishing characteristic. You can claim your Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, but you're going to have to show it. In the past, we could claim our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights and shut up. The only thing that's changed is that now you've got to know why you're not going to speak. Under Miranda versus Arizona, in the old days, before the Miranda decision came down, if you were one of the few who knew that you had a right to remain silent, you could exercise that right. Most people didn't, and they'd go ahead and talk, and they still do to this day. They go ahead and talk, and then what they say can be used against them. The difference is that after Miranda, the court required that you at least inform the victim that he has a right to remain silent. Now, today, the officer is supposed to say to you, you have a right to remain silent, and anything that you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. In a Terry stop and frisk, any information you give him before he arrests you, you don't have to have a Miranda warning, and they can use it against you. So, the way the Terry case came down was that this policeman, a plainclothesman in Ohio, was watching three guys as they were casing a jewelry store for a robbery. Now, he didn't know that they were going to commit the robbery, and they hadn't committed the robbery yet, but they looked very suspicious. One would walk down the street, and he would stop at the corner, and he would talk to a guy, and then he'd walk back, and when he got down to the other corner, he'd talk to another guy. He did this three or four times, and Officer Terry, or whoever the officer was, I guess it was a policeman. Terry was the guy that they finally arrested. Well, this guy, the officer stopped Terry, and he frisked him. And, of course, later he found him with a concealed weapon, and they arrested him. He was out on probation or parole, and the case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court distinguished that. They said, well, it doesn't rise to the level of probable cause. But we're going to distinguish this kind of a stop and frisk as a Terry stop. All right, so now, 36 years ago, we come up with this Terry rule. And about the same time, we came up with the Miranda rule. That doesn't abolish the Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment. But what it does is it gives the police a little bit of latitude here. In other words, this guy could be armed and dangerous. And when the policeman stopped him, he said, I wanted to make sure that this guy wasn't armed, or if he was, I knew about it. All right, now we're deciding this Heibel case. Our analysis includes Terry and the Terry stop and frisk. It's the basis of this new Heibel distinction. Now, before we get any further into this, let me show you what the Boston Herald reported on 6/21. The same case, but their report is what I call yellow journalism. It starts off by saying, Washington, the Supreme Court ruled Monday that people do not have a constitutional right to refuse to tell police their names. I'm going to dissent from that. I don't believe that for a minute. This case does not represent that. You still have the same constitutional right to refuse to disclose your name. But in the past, it was, as Heibel said, kiss off, I don't want to talk to you. Today, it's going to be qualified. You're going to have a reason why you don't give the police your name. The 5-4 decision, the Boston Globe goes on to say, frees the government to arrest and punish people who will not cooperate by revealing their identity. No, that's not quite true either. There's a qualifying test, and if we can meet the qualifying test, we can still use Lawson and Brown. The decision was a defeat for privacy rights advocates who argued that the government could use the power to force people who have done nothing wrong other than catch the attention of police to divulge information that may be used for broad database searches. That's only partially true. They can make the claim. It's up to you to withstand it. And if you can do that, nothing has changed. Police, meanwhile, had argued that identification requests are a routine part of detective work, including efforts to get information about terrorists. That's probably true. And in Brown, the court said, you have a duty to ask him. He doesn't have a duty to respond. And the justices upheld a Nevada cattle rancher's misdemeanor conviction. He was arrested after he told a deputy that he didn't have to reveal his name or show an ID during an encounter on rural road back in 2000. Larry Heibel was prosecuted based on his silence and fined $250. The Nevada Supreme Court sided with police on a 4-3 vote. So it was a split decision in the Nevada Supreme Court and a split decision 5-4 in the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices agreed in a unique ruling that addresses just what is in a name. It is true. This is a unique ruling. Now, the ruling was a follow-up to a 1968 decision that said police may briefly detain someone on reasonable suspicion of wrongdoing without the stronger standard of probable cause to get more information. Justices said that during such a brief detention, known as a Terry stop after the 1968 ruling, people must answer questions about their identities. All right, now in this Terry stop, it is a little broader. You can ask the guy these questions, but the court said he doesn't have to answer. So you have to know when to keep your mouth shut, and you have to know what questions to ask. This is why I mentioned to you, you ought to get your law from the Supreme Court and the case itself rather than from the newspaper. Any average Joe Sixpack reading this is going to say, oh my God, they've now taken away our Fifth Amendment rights. No, we haven't done that. Not yet. Yeah, that's still in the future. Now, going back to the Heibel case, the Supreme Court went on to say this, talking about Heibel. It says, this present case begins where our prior cases left off. Here, there is no question that the initial stop was based on reasonable suspicion. All right, so he met the Terry rule, the officer did, satisfying the Fourth Amendment requirements noted in Brown. So Brown versus Texas has not been overturned. Brown versus Texas set up standards by which the police had to perform. In this case, the policeman performed well under the Brown test. Further, the petitioner was not alleged or has not alleged that the statute is unconstitutionally vague. I don't know why he didn't. He was represented by the public defender's office. Public defender. I've never heard of the public defender taking a case to the U.S. Supreme Court, but in this case they did. No doubt they relied upon Colander, Lawson v. Colander, and Brown v. Texas, Delaware versus Prowse. Whether they raised Terry or not, I don't know. But they relied on previous case law. But in this case, it's distinguished between this guy never said, I'm not going to give you this information because you're going to put it in a database and find out that I've got a warrant out from my arrest. Which, had he done that, the court would have ruled under Brown and Colander and he would have walked. But this is valuable information for you and I, so that now in the future we will know, you and I, we will know that we have one more step we have to take if we're not going to identify ourselves, and that is to show that this investigation, along with the identification, that is my name, is going to be the beginning point of a criminal investigation to be used against me, and I'm the target. Now, here the Nevada statute is narrower and more precise. The statute in Colander had been interpreted to require a suspect to give the officer credible and reliable identification. In contrast, the Nevada Supreme Court has interpreted to require only that a suspect disclose his name. He doesn't have to identify himself. Just give me your name. Now, this raises a question in my mind. What if I told him my name is Kelly McGillicuddy? I give him a false name. The statute requires that I identify myself. I don't know what the penalty would be or what the outcome would be if I gave him a name after I said, identify yourself. So if I identified myself and said, I'm Kelly McGillicuddy, which isn't true, but I've complied with the statute, I identified myself, and I gave you the name. Now, I don't know how that would come out. I don't know if that's a criminal, a separate criminal act or not. You need to ask the policeman. If I give you a name and it's not true, are you going to punish me for that? Well, yes, I am. Well, and I guess I can't give you a fictitious name or a pseudoname or any other name. So, okay, now I need to go on to the next question. Now, the suspect, the court goes on to say, is not required to provide private details about his background. You don't have to give him a driver's license that gives him your address and phone number, social security number, just the name. But merely to state his name to an officer when reasonable suspicion exists. So I suppose we ought to ask the officer, is this a Terry stop and frisk, and what is your reasonable suspicion? I mean, if he answers the question, no, this isn't a Terry stop, well then, why are you stopping me? Well, I'm just making a routine investigation. That's called a fishing expedition, specifically prohibited by the Fifth Amendment. Now, as we understand it, the court goes on to say, the statute does not require a suspect to give the officer a driver's license or any other document, provided that the suspect either states his name or communicates that name to the officer by some other means. You could give him a driver's license, a social security number. You could say, my name is Harry Smedley. It's a choice that we assume that the suspect may make. The statute is satisfied and no violation occurs. Now, Heibel argues that his conviction cannot stand because the officer's conduct violated his Fourth Amendment rights. We disagree. Asking questions is an essential part of a police investigation, and in the ordinary course of police work, the officer is free to ask a person for identification without implicating the Fourth Amendment. Well, let's just pause here for a second. He has a right to do that, but up until now, you had no corresponding right to answer. You could stand mute. Interrogation relating to one's identity or a request for identification by the police does not by itself constitute a Fourth Amendment seizure. Beginning with Terry versus Ohio, the court has recognized that a law enforcement officer's reasonable suspicion that a person may be involved in criminal activity permits the officer to stop the person for a brief time and take additional steps to investigate further. To ensure that the resulting seizure is constitutionally reasonable, a Terry stop must be limited. The officer's action must be justified at its inception, and it must reasonably be related in scope to the circumstance which justified the interference in the first place. Now, for example, the seizure cannot continue for an excessive period of time or resemble a traditional arrest. So our decisions make clear that questions concerning a suspect's identity are a routine and accepted part of many Terry stops. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime, what should you say to the police or investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. Now, after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for home education. If you're online, just go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. While we're on the subject, if you'd like this series of questions, 12 questions here that I have devised for asking the police to qualify your stop, your Terry stop, for Fifth Amendment review by the Supreme Court, just send me a $5 bill in an envelope. Not $5 in gold now, just a $5 Federal Reserve note in an envelope to cover the cost of postage and handling and copying, etc. And I'll send you a companion article on, do the police have a duty to protect individuals? The answer to that is no, they don't. And surprisingly, many people have been duped into believing that the police have a duty, and if they fail to protect you from criminals, you have a right to sue. The answer is an unqualified no, you don't. So if the police don't protect you and you're assaulted by a criminal, you have no recourse. The same police, though, can come up to you and ask you questions. And if you fail to give them the right answers, especially now as we see in identification, in 20 states at least, you can be arrested and jailed, prosecuted and fined, maybe even spend some time in jail in a sentence for refusing to identify yourself pursuant to this new standard. It isn't that you don't have a right to refuse to identify yourself, it's that you now have to meet this new standard. So if you'd like to do that, a $5 bill in an envelope to the law school. We'll give you the address here as we progress along. Now notice here that the ability, the Supreme Court says, the ability to briefly stop a suspect, ask questions, or check identification in the absence of probable cause promotes the strong government interest in solving crimes and bringing offenders to justice. Now if there are articulable facts supporting a reasonable suspicion that a person has committed a criminal offense, that person may be stopped in order to identify him, to question him briefly, or to detain him briefly while attempting to obtain additional information. A brief stop of a suspicious individual in order to determine his identity or to maintain the status quo momentarily while obtaining more information may be most reasonable in light of the facts known to be or known to the officer at the time. Obtaining a suspect's name in the course of a Terry stop serves important government interests. Knowledge of identity may inform an officer that a suspect is wanted for other offense or has a record of violence or mental disorder, or, on the other hand, knowing identity may help clear a suspect and allow the police to concentrate their efforts somewhere else. Identity may prove particularly important in cases such as this, where the police are investigating what appears to be a domestic assault. Officers called to investigate domestic disputes need to know whom they're dealing with in order to assess the situation, the threat to their own safety, and possible danger to the potential victim. Now, although it is well established that an officer may ask a suspect to identify himself in the course of a Terry stop, it has been an open question as to whether the suspect can be arrested and prosecuted for refusal to answer. See Brown. Now, Brown versus Texas is cited at 443 U.S. 47. It's an important case for you to read. It's 443 U.S. 47, Brown versus Texas, 1979. The petitioner draws our attention to statements in prior opinions that, according to him, answer the question in his favor. In Terry, Justice White stated in a concurring opinion that a person detained in an investigative stop can be questioned but is not obliged to answer. Answers may not be compelled, and refusal to answer furnishes no basis for an arrest. Now, the court cited this opinion, a custodial stop requiring the protections of Miranda versus Arizona. Right now, Miranda versus Arizona is another important case to read. It's a little off point as we're discussing this case here with identification, but it's cited at 384 U.S. 436. It was decided in 1966. Remember, that's Miranda versus Arizona, 384 U.S. 436, 1966. It's 109 pages, so don't just order it, you know, off of Lexis, because they'll charge you an arm and a leg. You want to go copy that or take it off of the Find Law people here, the Find Law website. Now, in the course of explaining why Terry stops have not been subjected to Miranda, the court suggested reasons why Terry stops have a non-threatening character, among them the fact that a suspect detained during a Terry stop is not obliged to respond to questions. Now, according to petitioner, these statements establish a right to refuse to answer questions during a Terry stop. Now, this is why the minority in this case said, wait a minute, we've already decided in a Terry stop that the guy can remain silent. All right, now here's the distinguishing characteristic. You can remain silent. You don't have to answer any other question other than your name. Now, if you can show that by giving your name, you're also exposing yourself to potential hazard or arrest, then you can refuse to give your name also. But what the court is saying here in this new distinguished case is that it's up to you to show that there is a hazard or that there is a fear, a reasonable suspicion on your part, a reasonable belief on your part, that by giving your name it could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation. The burden's on you now. Up until Heibel, the burden was on the government. Today, they've reversed that burden. They haven't changed the law. Nothing's different than it was the day before they issued this opinion. What they have added to the rule is now the burden is on you to show that you're in danger, not the police. So obtaining a suspect's name in the course of a Terry stop serves important government interests. Now, although it is well established that an officer may ask a suspect to identify himself in the course of a Terry stop, it has been an open question as to whether the suspect can be arrested and prosecuted for refusal to answer. The petitioner draws our attention to statements in prior opinions that, according to him, answer the question in his favor. So in Terry, Justice White stated in a concurring opinion that a person detained in an investigative stop can be questioned, but is not obliged to answer. All right, now underline not obliged to answer. Because now in 20 states, you are obliged to answer, at least with your name only, unless you can show that you have a reasonably based fear that by identifying your name, telling your name, could be the beginning point of a criminal investigation which could be used against you. Answers may not be compelled, and refusal to answer furnishes no basis for arrest. So the court cited this opinion in dicta in Berkemer, that's Berkemer versus McCarty, a decision holding that a routine traffic stop is not a custodial stop requiring the protections of Miranda versus Arizona. And in the course of explaining why Terry stops have not been subject to Miranda, the court suggested reasons why Terry stops have a non-threatening character, among them the fact that a suspect detained during a Terry stop is not obliged to respond to questions. All right, now you're obliged to respond to this one question, and that is, what is your name? If you don't want to give your name, then you have to replace that with 10 or 12 questions to establish why it is that you're in fear of giving that name, including a request for immunity from prosecution. You can see Berkemer. According to petitioner, these statements establish a right to refuse to answer questions during a Terry stop. Now, we don't read these statements as controlling. The passages recognize that the Fourth Amendment does not impose obligations on the citizen, but instead provides rights against the government. As a result, the Fourth Amendment itself cannot require a suspect to answer questions. This case concerns a different issue, however. Okay? Let me underline that. This case concerns a different issue, the court is telling us. So underline that. Here, the source of the legal obligation arises from Nevada state law, not the Fourth Amendment. So your legislature has enacted a statute and said, you're required to answer this question, what is your name? That's a statute. Now, if you're going to apply the Fourth or Fifth Amendments here, then you have to show why that statute is either one, unconstitutional on its face, or two, it's unconstitutional as it's being applied to me in this circumstance. Again, the law hasn't changed, but the burden is now changed. The burden is now on you to show. It used to be on the police. Now the burden is on you. The law doesn't change. Brown doesn't change. Lawson doesn't change. Terry doesn't change. Miranda doesn't change. Berkemer doesn't change. But now the burden has changed. The burden is on you to show why it is that you cannot give your name, because it would be the beginning point of a criminal investigation. Now, I can tell you that for practical purposes, there won't be very many people. It won't amount to 1% of the people in the country that will know how to apply this. You listening to me now will know how to apply it. And if you want these questions and the companion article on do the police have a duty to protect you, just drop a $5 bill in an envelope with your return address. We've got to have a place to mail it. And I'll have those copied for you and send those to you. Just need enough to cover the cost of the postage and handling and somebody to go over here and copy it. That all costs a buck or two. Now, here the source of the legal obligation arises from the Nevada state law, not the Fourth Amendment. So remember that. Further, the statutory obligation does not go beyond answering an officer's question to disclose a name. And that's where the Nevada statute is distinguishable from the other state statutes on stop and identify. the other state statutes, and as you saw here in California, was vague and ambiguous because it went too far. It was overly broad. Now, a statute can be overly broad, or it can be vague and ambiguous. And any person so detained shall identify himself, but may not be compelled to answer any other inquiry of any peace officer. As a result, we cannot view the dicta in Berkemer or Justice White's concurrence in Terry as answering the question whether a state can compel a suspect to disclose his name during a Terry stop. All right. Now let's take a little break right here, and we'll be right back with more on personal identification when we return. You're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, when I'm asked who I would recommend for a lawyer, I always recommend Jerry Spence of Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Now, if you can't afford him, and he's pretty pricey, my second choice is you. That's right. You, the pro se litigant, you, the victim, you, the criminal, you, the person who's being prosecuted, to represent your own interests in court. After all, you were there, and you either did it or you didn't do it. You know who else was there. You know what was said, and you know who said it. You know who's lying. You know who's telling the truth. You know. But when you hire an attorney, your attorney does not know any more than you can tell him. Representing yourself in court or at trial is protected by the Sixth Amendment in three rules. It's don't say anything, keep quiet, and shut up. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary. It's a commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, it's free of charge, and tells you what we're all about. That's the place to start. Step one. Doesn't cost you anything to make an inquiry. And if you don't like it, throw it away and forget about it and enjoy the program on the air. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about personal identification, the majority view in a new case called Heibel. It's an odd spelling. It's H-I-I-B-E-L. Heibel, H-I-I-B-E-L, versus the 6th Judicial District Court of Nevada. The number is 03-5554. You can go to Find Law to get a copy. It's on the net, Find Law, number 03-5554. Just came out June 21st, 2004. All right, going on in the majority opinion, they continue to tell us some more. They say the principles of the Terry permit, or the principles of Terry permit a state to require a suspect to disclose his name in the course of a Terry stop. The reasonableness of a seizure under the Fourth Amendment is determined by balancing its intrusion on the individual's Fourth Amendment interests against its promotion of legitimate government interests. Now, that comes from a case called Delaware versus Prowse. Now, Delaware versus Prowse is an important case for you to read in context with this type of a case. It was a search and seizure of a guy in Delaware. The policeman just stopped him to be stopping him. He had no reasonable suspicion, no probable cause to make a stop. The case is Delaware versus Prowse. That's spelled P-R-O-U-S-E. The number is 440 U.S. 648. Also decided in 1979, the same year as Brown v. Texas. Delaware v. Prowse, 440 U.S. 648, 1979. And in the course of the stop of Prowse, they found drugs. Went on up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court overturned the conviction and said you didn't have any probable cause to make the stop to start with. In the Heibel case, the policeman has probable cause. it goes beyond reasonable suspicion. He has actual probable cause because somebody reported to him that a crime was being committed. And when the officer got there, there was a woman sitting in the pickup. And this guy, Heibel, was standing outside the pickup. Now, it had already been reported to him that there was a probable crime being committed. What it would look like here would be spousal abuse or a domestic disturbance. But nevertheless, he was called to the scene. The policeman had a reason to be there. He had a job to do. Now, we don't doubt, as the court said in Brown versus Texas, that the policeman has a duty to ask this fellow what his name is. He has a duty to investigate all of the circumstances surrounding what he's looking at. The constitutional question for us in this analysis is, does the defendant have a corresponding duty to answer those questions? Now, the court has already told us, you don't have any corresponding duty to answer any questions other than your name only. And remember, this is only in Nevada. The other 19 states, we don't know if their statutes would meet this constitutional muster of being narrowly tailored to the name only, which the court has concluded is not of and by itself incriminating. It could be incriminating, and in any cases where it is incriminating, you don't have to give your name. But the burden is on you to show that giving your name is likely to be incriminating. So the Nevada statute satisfies that standard. We don't know about the other 19 states. The request for identity has an immediate relation to the purpose, rationale, and the practical demands of a Terry stop. The threat of criminal sanction helps ensure that the request for identity does not become a legal nullity. On the other hand, the Nevada statute does not alter the nature of the stop itself. It does not change its duration. It doesn't change its place or its location. A state law requiring a suspect to disclose his name in the course of a valid Terry stop is consistent with Fourth Amendment prohibitions against unreasonable searches and seizures. So what if this is not a reasonable Terry stop and frisk to start with? That's the place to begin our analysis at the scene of the crime. So let's suppose that you're walking down the street and the policeman just walks up to you and says, hey, you, I want you to identify yourself under Nevada statute, blank, 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 blank. First thing we want to ask is this a Terry stop and frisk? Yes, it is. Second question would be, what is your articulable, reasonable suspicion for making this inquiry? This puts the policeman on the spot. It says, well, you look to me like you are Burt Parks and you are wanted for murder. Well, if I were to confess to you that my name is Burt Parks, I presume there's a warrant out for Mr. Parks' arrest. And if my name happens to be Burt Parks, then that would be the beginning point of a criminal investigation, which would involve me, would it not? There's an example of a case where this giving your name is going to be the beginning point of a criminal investigation that's going to involve you. This Terry stop and frisk isn't even a Terry stop. It's a fishing expedition. You look like, now tell me. If the officer wants to commit himself, he can walk up and say, hey, you're Burt Parks. I got a warrant for your arrest. You're under arrest. Turn around. From that point on, you don't have to tell this guy what your name is. Remember, this is in the context of Terry, not Miranda. Now, once Miranda comes into place and the policeman has arrested you, you can remain silent now. Telling your name is only going to put more gasoline on the fire. I mean, after all, if you're wanted for murder, what do you care about a misdemeanor charge of obstructing and delaying? All right, going on, the petitioner argues that the Nevada statute circumvents the probable cause requirement, in effect allowing an officer to arrest a person for being suspicious. Now, according to the petitioner, this creates a risk of arbitrary police conduct that the Fourth Amendment does not permit. All right, I got to point out that this is off point and out of context. The court now has nailed this guy's hide to the wall. This remember, this appeal now is being done by the Nevada Public Defender's Office. Let me read this sentence to you again. It says, the petitioner argues, this is the public defender's office is arguing for the petitioner, that the Nevada statute circumvents the probable cause requirement. Underline that. Probable cause requirement. Wait a minute. We don't need probable cause under a Terry stop. This officer did not go out to Heibel, arrest him, and then ask him what his name was. After you've been arrested, Miranda comes into play. Miranda is an absolute bar to making you answer any questions, including your name. But before you're arrested, what do you call it? It's not a Miranda, it's a Terry. So throughout this opinion, the court relies upon the Terry stop and frisk rule. And the Terry stop and frisk rule says, yeah, the officer can ask you your name. Up until Heibel, you didn't have to give it. After Heibel, in a Terry stop and frisk, you have to give the officer your name if you don't have any reason not to. Remember, if you don't have any reason not to. And in most cases, when the policeman comes up and asks you your name, he's looking for information concerning somebody else, not you. Now, let's suppose, just for the sake of our discussion, you're walking down the street and a red car goes through a red light and hits the green car. And you're standing there watching this whole thing come down. And the police come over and they say, well, did you see this accident? Did you want to get involved? Did you want to say, yes, I saw this accident. Okay, well, then what's your name? Well, I'm not going to tell you. It's none of my business. Well, yes, it is the policeman's business. He has to secure witnesses to this event, and you as a citizen have a duty to give him your name. What if you're Burt Parks and there's a warrant out for your arrest? And maybe you're wanted for murder or jumping ship in Seattle. You've deserted the Navy. And as soon as he gets this name, a question arises, well, are you going to put this name into a database? And if you put this name in a database, are you going to arrest me if there's a warrant out for my arrest? Now, there's a reason for you to remain silent, isn't it? But typically, and the Supreme Court's reasoning here is that just telling the policeman your name isn't incriminating of and by itself, which is true. It isn't of and by itself. It could be. Now, I'm a civil rights investigator, a civil rights worker. Let's picture me, you know, a black civil rights worker working in Montgomery, Alabama in the 1950s and 60s. Heck, I might have a warrant out for my arrest, and I don't know anything about it. I just travel from city to city, stirring up hate and discontent against the government. And maybe I'm wanted in Selma, Alabama, or Jackson, Mississippi, or Raleigh, North Carolina, where I've been working in civil rights work. And I pull into Montgomery, Alabama, and maybe I want to ride the front of the bus. And the policeman asks me my name. I don't want this policeman to know that I'm a civil rights worker and that I've been arrested many times before, and that maybe I've got two or three arrest warrants out for my arrest in two or three different states. And furthermore, I don't have to. I can exercise my rights at this juncture of time. Again, let me emphasize, the burden now is on me. It's on me. That's what Heibel represents. The burden is now shifted from the police or the government to you. But this comes under the Terry rule, not the Miranda rule. two totally separate events. Under Miranda, you're already under arrest. Under Terry, you're not under arrest. You're just being asked some questions and stopped and frisked for a brief period of time prior to the arrest. So the rules are different. All right, hang on here for a second. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, many of the lessons that you hear on this Law Hour program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. Now, this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, a summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom either. You'll learn preliminary procedures, like we're talking about right here. Arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there's 28 essential elements that you have to master in courtroom strategy and procedure. Not 280 or 2,800, just 28. 28 things, and you'll learn all of those here at the law school in this class. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and it's the place to start. First thing you do, get the CD package. Courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for home education. So if you can't come to law school, we'll take the school to you and put it right there in your home. If you're online, go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email. Send me an email request for that free general law CD package. And you should do it right now before you forget. Remember the number, 417-273-4967 or georgegordon.org. Now, if you'd like to have these 12 questions that you need to be able to ask the police so that you'll know what to ask, along with a companion article on do the police have a duty to protect you from criminals? Surprisingly, they don't. Do you know the cases? Do you know why the police have no duty to protect any citizen in America from crime or criminals? Not a one, and the courts have ruled on it numerous times. You may think that the police have a duty to protect you, when in fact they don't. And furthermore, the police know they don't have any such duty. All right, we're talking about a case called Heibel. This is the majority opinion. The petitioner further contends that his conviction violates the Fifth Amendment's prohibition on compelled self-incrimination. So the public defender's office came in with two arguments, Fourth and Fifth Amendments, based upon Brown v. Texas and Lawson v. Colander. Now, the Fifth Amendment states that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. To qualify for the Fifth Amendment privilege, a communication must be testimonial. Underline that. The communication must be testimonial, incriminating, and compelled. So whatever the question that's being asked has to be testimonial, number one, incriminating, number two, and compelled, number three. All right, your name is testimonial. My name is George Gordon. It must be compelled. If you don't tell me your name, I'm going to arrest you and jail you. That's compelling. And it must be incriminating. I'm not going to give you my name because there might be a warrant out for my arrest. Can you guarantee me, officer, that there's no warrant for my arrest? Now, that's just one of 12 questions that I've concluded that you have to ask the officer to make an informed decision right there at the scene. What if the officer said to you, yes, I will give you immunity from prosecution. Promise. Put it in writing. Get it signed. Then give him your name. You'll be exactly where Oliver North was when he had his get-out-of-jail-free card from Congress. It's called immunity from prosecution. Three elements, testimonial, incriminating, and compelled. And that comes from a case called United States versus Hubble. Now, the respondents urge us to hold that the statements requires, that the Nevada statute requires, are non-testimonial, and so outside the clause's scope. Now, we decline to resolve the case on that basis. To be testimonial, an accused communication must itself explicitly or implicitly relate a factual assertion or disclose information. That comes from Doe versus United States. Now, if the case is labeled Doe versus United States, they didn't have his name. And we don't need your name to prosecute you. Let's suppose that this guy, Heibel, had refused to give his name. Does that mean, gee, if I don't have your name, I can't arrest you? You mean that the policeman has to know the name of a bank robber before he can arrest him? That's ludicrous. We may never find out what your name is. We don't need your name to prosecute and convict you, send you to prison, and you can serve your full time under the name of John Doe. It's been done before. I suspect it may even be done again. So stating one's name may qualify as an assertion of fact relating to identity. Production of identity documents might meet the definition as well. As we noted in Hubble, acts of production may yield testimony establishing the existence, authenticity, and custody of items that the police are seeking. Even if these required actions are testimonial, however, the petitioner's challenge must fail because in this case, disclosure of his name presented no reasonable danger of incrimination. No reasonable danger of incrimination. In this case, notice the term, in this case. The court isn't excluding in all cases. They're not saying that when this comes up again at some point in the future, that giving your name may not incriminate you. Your job is to show that you have reasonable belief, a reasonable expectation that the revealing of your name could lead to. And after all, the policeman isn't in any position to give you immunity from prosecution from a warrant that he sees issued on NCIC. Now, the Fifth Amendment prohibits only compelled testimony that is incriminating. Let's underline that. Only compelled testimony that is incriminating. Nothing that where the answer of the witness will not directly show his infamy, but only tend to disgrace him, he is bound to answer. A claim of Fifth Amendment privilege must establish, quote, reasonable grounds to apprehend danger to the witness from his being compelled to answer. The danger to be apprehended must be real and appreciable, with reference to the ordinary operation of law in the ordinary course of things, not a danger of an imaginary and unsubstantial character, having reference to some extraordinarily and barely possible contingency, something that is so improbable that that no reasonable man would suffer it to influence his conduct. Well, let me give you this example again. NCIC, every time you're stopped by the police in a traffic stop, the first thing the policeman does is take your license back to his car and run your identification through the National Crime Information Center, NCIC, to see if there's any other outstanding warrants for your arrest. Well, my goodness, boys and girls, my common sense tells me that when the policeman comes up and says, what's your name? And I ask him, is this a criminal investigation? And he says, yes, it is. Immediately, I become unsettled. Oh, my gosh. So as we stated in Castigar versus United States, the Fifth Amendment privilege against compulsory self-incrimination protects against any disclosures that the witness reasonably believes could be used in a criminal prosecution or could lead to other evidence that might be so used. Suspects who have been granted immunity from prosecution may therefore be compelled to answer. With the threat of prosecution removed, there can be no reasonable belief that the evidence will be used against them. So, if the policeman says, I will give you immunity from prosecution, then you have no reason not to give him the name, as long as you get it in writing. His verbal communication can be reneged at a later date. Has to be in writing. In this case, the petitioner's refusal to disclose his name was not based on any articulable, real, and appreciable fear that his name would be used to incriminate him, or that it would furnish a link in the chain of evidence needed to prosecute him. Such as, gee, if I tell you my name, are you going to pull a warrant out of NCIC? As best as I can tell, the petitioner refused to identify himself only because he thought his name was none of the officer's business. Even today, the petitioner does not explain how the disclosure of his name could have been used against him in a criminal case. While we recognize the petitioner's strong belief that he should not have to disclose his identity, the Fifth Amendment does not override the Nevada legislature's judgment. To the contrary, absent a reasonable belief that the disclosure would tend to incriminate him. So you have to have a reasonable belief that it would incriminate you. Now, the narrow scope of the disclosure requirement is also important. A person's identity is by definition unique, yet it is, in another sense, a universal characteristic. Answering a request to disclose a name is likely to be so insignificant in the scheme of things as to be incriminating only in very unusual circumstances. Suggesting that fact that the state could readily establish may render any testimony regarding the existence or authenticity of them insufficiently incriminating. In every criminal case, it is known and must be known who has been arrested and who is being tried. Even witnesses who plan to invoke the Fifth Amendment privilege answer when their names are called to take the witness stand. Still, a case may arise where there is a substantial allegation that furnishing identity at the time of a stop would give or would have given the police a link in the chain of evidence needed to convict the individual of a separate offense. In that case, the court can then consider whether the privilege applies and if the Fifth Amendment has been violated. What remedy must follow? We need not resolve those questions in this case. So there's the answer. In the majority opinion, the last sentence, we'll decide that if it's necessary in the next case that comes before us. Now, in the next session, tomorrow night, we'll take a look at Justice Stevens' dissenting opinion and then the three concurring dissenting opinions. And I'll show you what the minority view was concerning this case. I happen to agree with the minority. However, the minority is not the law of America today. The majority view is. And until this is reversed out, we have a new distinguishable characteristic to follow. Now, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website, georgegordon.org. Well, there's the signal that says our time is up. I'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing. So until then, goodbye, friends.